Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Surviving Africa can be hard, even harder for children facing poverty, slavery, war, prostitution, smacked into life awareness by the problems of generations before them. Jesuit priest and Nigerian author Uwem Akpan sees Africa through the eyes of children in a powerful new collection of short stories. It is a breathtaking view. This hour On Point, Uwem Akpan gives voice to Africa's children. Joining me now from Southfield, Michigan is Uwem Akpan. He's a Nigerian-born writer and an ordained Jesuit priest. He has an MFA in creative writing from the University of Michigan and now teaches English composition at a seminary in Zimbabwe. His first book, out last month, is a collection of short stories. It's titled, Say You're One of Them. Uwem Akpan, it's very good to have you with us. Thanks for being here.
Thank you. Hello, Tom.
Hi. It's a remarkable collection of stories, just five, and it's nearly 350 pages. You've got some novella-length stories in here.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you.
It's really, really something. And each and every one through the eyes of children. We have so many questions for you, but let's just start there. You've seen a lot as a Nigerian and African and as a Jesuit priest. Why did you decide to tell these stories in the voices of children?
First of all, thank you for inviting me to your show, and thank you for what you say about the collection. When I see Africa or being represented out here in the West,
yeah,
or even when I read about difficult issues back home in Africa, say in Nigeria, the articles are usually written from the perspective of the adults. And sometimes they begin that article with a portrait of a child to grab the reader's attention. Now, by the time you get to paragraph 3, the essay, you know, recites into statistics and data and analysis, and we lose the perspective of that child until towards the end, in a line or two, it concludes, you know, that article.
You've got the journalist trick down all too well. You recognize the structure. Yes, yes, of course. We've all read that structure many times.
Yes. So I was thinking, what would it mean to sit with that child and go through the processing of these, you know, images and reality with that child? And I looked around. I did not see any collection of short stories that did that. At least, you know, I did not see. Maybe there is a collection out there. And I said to myself, maybe this is what I can, you know, I can do, what I can bring to the table. And I started, you know, fashioning my stories from the perspective of, you know, children.
These are remarkable stories set in five different countries in Africa, always children up against what we think of adults facing and seldom put ourselves in the minds of children. My Parents' Bedroom, set in Rwanda from the perspective of a 9-year-old girl, Monique, who will, in the course of your story, watch her father is Hutu, her mother is Tutsi. This is set during the genocide, infamously in Rwanda. She will watch as her father is forced to take her mother's life in front of her in that bedroom. But it starts so tender. Luxurious Hearses, set in Nigeria, your home country. A 16-year-old boy, Jubril, posing as a Christian to escape violence in the northern area of Nigeria. And right on, Fattening for Gabon. Set in Benin with the brother and sister. Parents have AIDS. They've been sent to their uncle. They're being fattened for sale into human trafficking by their own uncle. Just heartbreaking. And then your very first story in this collection, An Xmas, as in Christmas Feast, set in Nairobi, Kenya, in the slums there. the perspective of an 8-year-old boy on his sister. He's, what, 8? Jigana? His sister's Maisha, 12 years old. And you open it with this absolutely heartrending, you know, sort of look. It's, now that my eldest sister, Maisha, was 12, none of us knew how to relate to her anymore. She'd never forgiven our parents for not being rich enough to send her to school. She's taken up prostitution at 12. Sometimes Mama went out of her way to provoke her. Malaya, whore, you don't even have breasts yet, she'd say. Maisha would ignore her as she went out into the streets of Nairobi. These are tough, tough situations. What do you know about slum life, Uem Akpan?
I grew up in a village which is different from, you know, the slums. I'm not writing autobiography, but, you know, in the course of my life, I've worked with poor people. When I was in Kenya, I used to go to Kibera slums and walk around and try to notice things. And then some of my parishioners were from the slums. So I tried to, you know, write about the things I was seeing, what I was feeling. And about these street kids, I realized that the larger society was no longer seeing them.
Mm-hmm.
They're all over the streets doing their things. They could be dangerous. And so sometimes people are justifiably worry of their presence. But I just, you know, realized that some of them were still very nice, very decent. And these were children, 8 years old, 7 years, you know. So I thought I could try to get into their world and see from inside what that world felt like.
I wish you'd read for us straight from the top of Xmas Feast. Here's Maisha saying someday she's got to get a real job, by which she means full-time prostitution in a brothel. Could you read for us there?
Someday I must to find a real job, Maisha said, sighing. What job, gal? That's Jigana speaking, the brother.
Brother. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I want to try full-time. Wapi? She shrugged. Mombasa? Da. I shook my head. Bad news, big gal. How long? I don't know. Ni Maisha yangu, guy. It's my life. I'm thinking, full-time will allow me to pay your fees and also save for myself. I will send money through the church for you. I'll quit the brothel when I save a bit. I don't want to stand on the road forever. Me, myself, must go to school one day. The words died in her throat. She pursed her lips, folded her hands across her chest, and rocked from side to side. She did not rush to any more cars. We won't see you again, I said. No, thanks. If you enter brothel, me, I won't go to school. Then I get to keep my money, ha ha. Without you, they won't see my shilling in that house. Never. She saw my face, stopped suddenly, then burst into giggles. I was kidding you, guy, about the brothel. Just kidding, okay? She tickled me, pulling me toward Moy Avenue. I held her hand tightly. Prostitutes fluttered about under streetlights, dressed like winged termites. Maisha, our parents, she turned sharply. Her fists balled. Shut up. You shame me, you rat. Leave me alone. Me, I'm not your mate. You can't afford me. Other girls turned and stared at us, giggling. Maisha strode away. It had been a mistake to mention our parents in front of the other girls, to let them know that we were related. And I shouldn't have called her by her real name. I cried all the way home because I had hurt her. She ignored me for weeks.
Oum Akpan, reading from his short story, An Xmas Feast, from his collection, Say You're One of Them. This just awful, wonderful combination of the warm banter between an 8 and 12-year-old brother and sister, the kind of loving affection, and then stakes so high. The sister going away into a brothel, neither of them getting schooling, their alienation from the parents and the family's need so acute. I mean, it's beautiful and almost unbearable at the same time. Is that the magic you intended?
Tom, I'm glad the stories came together. I'm glad the stories came together. And the writing process, I know a bit about it, but, much of it is a mystery to me. And, so I'm just grateful after working for 8 years, the book came together.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with the breakout Nigerian writer Oum Akpan about his shattering, really, debut short story collection, Seeing Africa Through the Eyes of Its Children. It's called Say You're One of Them, as in, say you're one of them when the others come to kill you, to kill us. Oum Akpan joins us from Southfield, Michigan. Oum Akpan, I first heard about your book from Maureen Corrigan. She does book reviews for Fresh Air on NPR, and she gave it such a powerful review. I had to learn more right away. She was struck by the fact that you're a Jesuit priest and you're writing about these hard, hard, often awful situations, and she said you're the perfect guy to ask the multi-million-dollar theological question. And so we will ask you. Give us a little sense of the priest behind the writer. What about it, sir? Why? Here's the question. Why does God permit evil to flourish in this world, Africa or elsewhere?
Yes, it's really a million-dollar question. And you know what, Tom? I don't have the answer.
But you're our Jesuit and our writer.
Yes. I don't have the answer. All I can say, is this. God has allowed us a lot of responsibility by giving us free will. And when I say this, I mean, I'm not talking natural disasters and, human beings don't have control over this. But where we're talking about evil coming from one man towards another, in most cases, it's people using their free will, their freedom, and freedom is a good thing, if you look at it. And now I choose to use this freedom to do something evil to another human being. Okay? And sometimes it's ironic for me to notice that this question is being pressed, the button is being pressed very, hard by Americans who love freedom, everybody wants to be free all the time. And yet, sometimes you are not able to stand the result of this freedom, or, we don't match it up with a lot of personal responsibility. And sometimes this leads to, innocent suffering. The folks who bombed America in September 2001, they brought us a lot of pain and misery, and the innocent suffered. Okay? Mm. But these people, they had the freedom not to do what they did. They also had the freedom to do it. And they chose, to do what they did. So I think freedom is a good thing. And God has generously given us, this freedom. How are we as human beings going to use this freedom? Are we going to demonize other people? Because once we do that, we now make it possible to hurt them. Okay, how are people seeing us? How are we seeing people? And the issue of partisan hatred, you know, comes up often in my, you know, in my writing. Tribalism, religion, you know, race, and you know, and all that. So this is why I'm saying to you, I don't have an answer to the problem of evil, and this is what I offer in a place of an answer.
You know, I mean, I asked it that way, but when you put it in terms of why does God permit this and ask a Jesuit, it makes it sound so grand. But the fact of the evil, the way it's considered and the way it's done is so banal in so many of your stories. When you're opening one, fattening for Gabon, and this is where the brother and sister have been sent to their uncle because their parents are dying of AIDS, and he turns out to be getting ready to sell them to human traffickers. Mm-hmm. And the boy is watching the uncle, Fofokpi, I guess is his name.
Yeah, Fofokpi.
He opens with this observation, you know, selling your child or nephew could be more difficult than selling other kids. You had to keep a calm head. I mean, it's almost so casual. Ultimately, the uncle it's a towering challenge for him, but it begins with such a casual reference. So it's a little more difficult to sell your own child.
Yeah, yeah. And you know what, Tom? Look at how we got to this Iraq war. Look at the brainwashing. Look at the manipulation. And a lot of us in this country, we were like, yes, let's go to war. I mean, there were people who said, wait a minute. You know, so if this could be done to adults, and at this point, a lot of Iraqis have died, a lot of American soldiers have died also. And it's not, you know, we are not done yet in Iraq. Peace has not, the peace we thought we were going to bring there has not arrived yet. If this could be done to adults, you know, then put children in that place, and you'll see what I mean. I mean, when we talk of human trafficking, think about all these ladies in Eastern Europe and in Africa who are told there is a job out there in Europe or in America, come over and get that job. And they believe, there's a whole process to make them believe, and they arrive in the West, and they're shoved into brothels. And, you know, there is no way, you know, it becomes very difficult. If this could happen to adults, then you can see how, you know, this, you know, the children with their innocence could be ensnared, you know, in this way.
How? Tell us something about more about your youth and how you ended up going from childhood in Nigeria to becoming a Jesuit priest and your education there in Africa, in Nebraska, ultimately in Michigan. Give us a little more of your story.
Yes, I was born in 1971 in the village of Ikorokpaneda in southeastern Nigeria. I lived with my grandparents for this first 6 years of my life. And by the way, my paternal uncles live in one big compound. Everybody has his own house, but it's in one big compound. Mm-hmm. And so we had lots of kids in my compound, and we played a lot. That's what I remembered in my, you know, of my childhood. We played a lot. We were constantly making toys, and I never got to school until age 6. So, you know, it was waking up, you know, going to morning prayers or to mass and playing and going to the stream and playing soccer and listening to, you know, to the adults tell stories, you know, fables and folklore, you know, that sort of thing.
And that sense of play remains in your stories among these children, even in the most desperate circumstances. We can hear it in your voice.
Yeah, it was good. Lots of food, You know, especially around Christmas. Oh, no, lots of food. And
but a Jesuit priest, that can't be a typical path, even there. How did you get on it?
Get on what? Excuse me?
The path to being a Jesuit priest.
Yeah, I went to high school. After high school, I applied to join the Society of Jesus, and they accepted me in 1990. I stayed with them for 3 years in Nigeria, and I was sent to Creighton University, which is a Jesuit university in this country, in Nebraska, to study humanities.
That's a long way from Nigeria.
Yes. It was not easy to break into the American culture, but Omaha was very good to me. And I love Omaha, and the people there are down to earth, you know, pretty much like, you know, the rest of the Midwest. So I went through a lot there in terms of growth and being able actually to see my culture from a distance and, you know, and try to compare my culture with the American culture, and then to come to some peace within me that these Americans were acting out of the same motivations as my people back home on the Atlantic coast, you know? And then to come to accept, you know, many things I was seeing here that were different from my, you know, my place. I learned a lot about writing there, about, you know, history, about photography, and, you know, many things. From there, I went to Gonzaga University, Spokane, another Jesuit university, to study philosophy. I ended up with a degree in philosophy and a minor in English. Then I went back to Nigeria to work for 3 years in high schools and parishes, and did an internship in the Catholic at the Catholic Secretariat, the National Catholic Secretariat in Nigeria. That's when I started writing fiction. After that, I went to Kenya for 3 years of theology. I was finally ordained in 2003 after 13 years of being a Jesuit. I worked for a year in high school in Nigeria and then came out to the University of Michigan to do my MFA in creative writing.
Let's take a call from Myrtle Beach, South Carolina, and to Jason. Hi, Jason. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I read Say You're One of Them this summer, and it wasn't until afterwards that I discovered that Mr. Akpan was a Jesuit priest, and I was really surprised because the story Luxurious Hearses seems to show sort of the divisive and socially destructive power that religion can have in society, I guess, especially in Africa. And having read other authors like Chinua Achebe and Wallace Anga, the story seemed to likewise show the destructive and divisive power of religion, especially in Africa. I was just curious how Mr. Akpan marries the idea that religion can be a very, like I said again, socially destructive tool in Africa with his notion of being a very devout Jesuit priest. I'm just not sure how he hopes with having both ideas simultaneously.
Jason, stick with us. We'll hear his response and what you make of it. But Akpan, how about it? In this story that Jason references, Luxurious Hearses, you've got Jibril, teenage Muslim, and he's fleeing religious sectarian violence in northern Nigeria. The Luxurious Hearse, maybe the big bus he's on, things turn into quite a mess. He's already lost one hand to religious justice of a kind. What about Jason's question? You know, he didn't know you were a Jesuit, and he takes away a message that religion can be quite destructive in your home continent.
Yeah, thank you, Jason, for asking that question, which I have heard, you know, as I go around doing my book tour. Religion, like any other thing in life, can be used for a good cause and can also be used for an evil cause. And if you read my story, you will see how good people are trying to retrieve religion from, you know, the evil cause some people have set it to. like the Muslim in that story, Abdullahi, who is ready, you know, to sacrifice his life and his entire family to save the Christians who are hidden in his house. And the Christians in southern Nigeria who are taking a tremendous risk trying to hide Muslims in their homes while the riots, you know, are going on. What I am saying in these stories, and in particular this story, apart from celebrating these people who were able to sacrifice a lot to actually, reenact the kind of thing Christ could have done and does talk about in the gospel, I'm also saying if we continue in this world to use religion like this, it's going to lead to a disaster. Especially in my country, if we use religion to manipulate people as we have done over the years, it's going to lead to us killing one of us. For if you look at it, Jibril is actually a southerner. And so for the Christians, the big question, we like to say as Christians, we are decent people, we are loving people, the Muslims are the bad ones. As Christians, are we able to forgive? So I do not know how else to bring this message anymore to the larger society than to, to say if we don't sit back and change and give up revenge and, if we don't embrace forgiveness and understanding, it's going to get us nowhere. And so you'll find even within this story, people trying to do the right thing, like that old woman in this story, trying to help Jibril at the end, and she's, pushed out of the way. So I hope this serves as some answer to your concern.
Jason in Myrtle Beach, how about it? Did you end up with the feeling that on balance, religion was a positive force in this story, or not?
Well, he definitely showed both sides of it with the religious people sheltering refugees and protecting them, even though I believe there were Christians sheltering Muslims. But also the destructive side. But at the end of the story, with both of these sides being represented, it's the destructive side rather than the harmonious side that wins, as Jibril is murdered because of his religion. So I guess when I finished the story, the idea I took away was that Mr. Akdan, obviously before I realized he's a Jesuit priest, his ultimate opinion was that the destructive side is going to win out, as it does in the story. That seemed like his final judgment on the weighing the balance of the harmonious side of religion versus the destructive side.
Jason, we appreciate your call. Uem Akpan, we have to take a short break. We'll come back and look at that. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with Nigerian-born writer Uem Akpan about his shattering debut short story collection, Seeing Africa Through the Eyes of Its Children. It is called Say You're One of Them, and we'll hear an excerpt from that title story from the book in just a moment. I should say, by the way, you can read and listen to an excerpt from the book at our website, onpointradio.org. Say You're One of Them, 5 stories, 350 pages, a couple novella length here, and incredibly powerful. He joins us today from Southfield, Michigan. Let's take a call from Westminster, Vermont, and Terry. Terry, you're on the air with Uem Akpan.
Hi. I just have a comment. The young man that was just previous to this commenting on how religion was a negative force, I feel just the opposite, that if anyone lived the tenets of their faith, whether you were a Christian, a Muslim, or you were Jewish, you would be the better person for it, and you would be helping people. More of a greater love hath no man than that religion was a negative thing.
But what about when we read into these stories when the sectarian conflict leads to such suffering, Terry? How do you reconcile that with your what I'm hearing is your faith there?
Well, because those things are man-made, not God-made. I mean, it's man doing this to man. It's not your religion. It's the absence of. Coming to the forefront.
Terry, thanks very much. Wim, that's a good chance for me to put Maureen Corrigan's other question to you. She says she wants to call you up and ask how someone with such an intimate knowledge of hell in his writings can still obviously affirm in his life the existence of a benevolent God.
Yes. I say yes. God is alive. Now to, you know, I thank you to the person who has just spoken to
Terry,
you, whose
yes.
name I have,
mm-hmm.
Terry, I've forgotten.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
You know, even if you look at that story, that novella, Luxurious Hazes, the soldier at the end sacrifices his life, you know, for that, you know, for that man. I don't think we're going to get very far with religion if this idea of self-sacrifice does not come in. And we seem to be losing that a lot in our, you know, in our lives. We need to see these people sacrificing. It's the same forces that killed Christ on Calvary, the forces of, okay, religion, politics. I am a believer. I believe in God. I believe in organized religion. As anything in the world, organized religion is not perfect, Tom. Okay? And we need to keep critiquing it, making it, you know, pointing out what is working in this, what is not working, and seeking to perfect it. And so I think I'm in a perfect position, being an insider, you know, to hold up these things to my fellow believers and say, is this what we set out to do? We can change the system. We can look for a way to make it better. And so when I criticize or when I mention, you know, the failure of UN in Rwanda, I'm not saying the UN is completely rotten. I'm not saying that. Mm. I'm saying we can make it, you know, better. I believe in God. I've always believed in God. And I don't see anything that will make me, I've not seen anything yet in the world that will make me shift from that, you know, from that belief. God has given us a lot of responsibilities, a lot of free will. How are we living with this free will?
It's not all about religion here. There's tremendous intimacy with poverty, with sectarian tribal conflict, genocide even. In your story in the Nairobi slum, the mother who gives her son glue to sniff, which sounds depraved, but then it's complicated because she's doing it in part to tamp down his hunger as Christmas approaches. She has no food, but she has glue for him. What a picture. And then you mentioned Rwanda. Of course, there's the story of my parents' bedroom where the children are ultimately forced to watch the most terrible interaction between their parents. This is the story where the title of the whole collection comes from. The mother who's telling her children without much explanation, she just wants them to know when they, some unnamed they, come and ask you, she says, mm-hmm. say you're one of them. But I wish you'd, she's anticipating what ultimately comes to pass in this story, but I wish you'd read for us from the top of this story, My Parents' Bedroom, Ulam Akpan. It sets up clearly this sort of delightful moment that many children have known when they think the parents getting ready to go out and they're loving and admiring this parent, but yet there's something so ominous in the background. Could you read for us from the top there?
I'm 9 years and 7 months old. I'm at home playing peekaboo in my room with my little brother, Jean. It's Saturday evening and the sun has fallen behind the hills. There's silence outside our bungalow, but from time to time the evening wind carries a shout to us. Our parents have kept us indoors since yesterday. Mamon comes into the room and turns off the light before we see her. John cries in the darkness, but once she starts kissing him, he begins to giggle. He reaches up to be held, but she's in a hurry. "Don't turn on any lights tonight," she whispers to me. I nod. "Yego, Mamon." come with your brother. I carry John and follow her. And don't open the door for anybody. Your papa is not home. I'm not home. Nobody's home. Do you hear me, Monique? Eh? Ego, maman. Swallow all your questions now, bright daughter. When your papa and uncle return, they'll explain things to you. Maman leads us through the corridor into her room, where she lights a candle that she has taken from our family altar in the parlor. She starts to undress, tossing her clothes on the floor. She tells us that she's going out for the night and that she's already late. She's panting as if she'd been running. Her body is shining with sweat. She slips into the beautiful black evening dress that Papa likes and combs out her soft hair. I help her with the zipper at the back of the dress. She paints her lips a deep red and presses them together. The sequins on her dress glitter in the candlelight as if her heart were on fire. My mother is a very beautiful Tutsi woman. She has high cheekbones, a narrow nose, a sweet mouth, slim fingers, big eyes, and a lean frame. Her skin is so light that you can see the blue veins on the back of her hands, as you can on the hands of Lopere Matin, our parish priest, who's from Belgium. I look like Maman, and when I grow up, I'll be as tall as she is. This is why Papa and all his Hutu people call me Shenge, which means my little one in Kenya, Rwanda. Papa looks like most Hutus, very black. He has a round face, a white nose, and brown eyes. His lips are as full as a banana. He is a jolly, jolly man who can make you laugh till you cry. Jean looks like him. But, Maman, you told me that only bad women go out at night. Monique, no question tonight. I told you.
Uwem Akpan, reading from the short story My Parents' Bedroom from his collection Say You're One of Them, and before long, the same child is narrating that people are banging on the front door, and the blades of machetes and axes are stabbing through that door, making holes in the plywood, and windows are smashed, and rifle butts are poking in, and I don't know what's going on, but the world knows the story of Hutu and Tutsi in Rwanda. When the genocide came there, above the ceiling in that same bedroom where his mother pretended to be going out, she will eventually hide along with other Tutsis and be discovered, and the ending is almost too terrible to take. Let's go to Jeff in Somerville, South Carolina. Jeff, you're on the air with Uwem Akpan.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Thank you, sir, for writing the stories about children. I'm a speech
Thank
pathologist.
You, Jeff.
You're welcome, sir. I'm a speech pathologist who worked with children for 28 years, and this spring I read a book that talks about the things that you have written in the Rwanda, and it was by a man. This is fact. It was by a young man, and he was in a village, and I believe he, in terms of his family, were the recipients of genocide. But he eventually made it to New York City and wrote a book, and the book is A Long Way Gone. I'm not sure if you have come across that book, but I would encourage readers to read that also, because it depicts in a child's language, as well as an ongoing dialogue as he became an adult and eventually made it to New York City, exactly what happens to his family and the people of his village. Truly a sad story, but one in which I believe it talks about the plight of children, as does your beautiful books.
Jeff, thank you very much for your call. Do you know the book,
Owen? Pardon?
Do you know the book?
I have heard about it, but I've not had a chance yet to read it.
And what about the general flow of books and reporting that comes out of Africa? It can seem awfully grim sometimes. Is that a fair depiction?
Yes, it is a fair. It's a fair depiction. But, I mean, what can one do about this? You know, Tom, if you live in a place and it's falling apart, what am I supposed to do? What are you supposed to do? If you are watching every time and you see the money in our continent has been stolen and stored in the West, in Asia, in the Middle East, in Europe, and in this country.
And banks in Switzerland.
Yes, that's in Europe, you know, all over, and I know very clearly that if I write you a check of $500 there in Boston, I mail you that check, you cannot touch that money for 5 days. You will not be able to access that money. What that means to me, or what that tells me, is the U.S. system, it's tracking this money. Where is this money coming from? What is Uwemakwan's income? Okay? So how come somebody is able to bring $1 billion to Europe, to the U.S., to Asia, and this bank's taking this money, and nobody says something? No, you know, the world can track down this money and ask the owner, you know, the people who brought this money, where did you earn this money? We used to say we could not do it in America until 9/11. You know, Tom, these days the federal government is ready to, you know, close any bank that does not release information so that we can check these terrorists and nail them before they nail us. So how come people have been suffering in these developing countries and the West continues to allow this money to come in, and this money comes into the West and this money bears profit and the interest is used to feed the children of the West, to take care of the children of the West, to send them to school, to create that peace that Switzerland is known for? Where is the outrage? Where is the justice?
Let me ask you, Your current position is at a school in Zimbabwe, but I can't help noticing you're in Michigan, not Zimbabwe, and the whole world has been watching Zimbabwe recently. What about that? Will you feel free to speak like this when you return, and when do you go back?
I work in Zimbabwe. I'll go back, you know, when I'm done with my, you know, with my assignments here and else, you know, elsewhere. Is it important to, you know, to point at, you know, the specific evils of Zimbabwe? I do not think so. I know there's a lot of suffering in that, you know, in that country, but I am disappointed in leadership in my continent, in my country of Nigeria, that is very rich. I wish I could, you know, cry to my leaders to save us and our children from disaster. So I, you know, they are not hearing us. But what about you out here where this money has been stolen and kept? You know, in my place they say if somebody steals money and brings it to your house and you keep this money, there's no other name to ascribe to you than you're a thief as well. How come these, you know, democracies in the West are keeping quiet and this money is used to, you know, to benefit them? A lot of money and resources have been stolen from Africa. So we are talking about one world, you know, globalization and all that. Okay, I'm glad that the West is always giving money back to Africa, you know, financial aids and all that. But how about really sitting down? Say the G8 has just finished its meeting. That money from Africa can be tracked down and returned to Africa.
Uwemakwan, with that, we're out of time. There's a bit of the man and the priest behind the writer, and quite an extraordinary writer. This collection really touched me. USA Today said, you never allow the bloodshed and degradation that suffers by your character to overwhelm their humanity or their humor and quirkiness. And it is indeed all there. We're grateful to you for the collection. Say You're One of Them. Listeners, you can read it. An excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. Uwemakwan, thank you very much for being with us today.
Hey, Tom, I'm very grateful. Thank you for inviting me to my, to your show, not my show.
Sounds like you could handle one. Thanks a lot. Good luck wherever your path takes you. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you. God bless.
You're welcome. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.